Greg, from time to time, we'll look at publications like Scientific American. This one has an article that mentions several people that you've debated. It's on physicist George Ellis. Physicist George Ellis knocks physicists for knocking philosophy, falsification, and free will. George Ellis, one of the preeminent physicists.
Well, he's a professor of astrophysics at University of Cape Town in South Africa. He is a brilliant cosmologist. When I was speaking at Illinois Wesleyan University several years ago, I met Tony Rothman, who is himself a cosmologist, and he referred to Ellis as the man who knows more about cosmology than any other man alive.
Really?
Now, that is a remarkable statement when you consider the great cosmologists that exist today, people like Hawking and Isham and others. And George Ellis is right at the top of the list. The thing I like about Ellis is that he's not simply a fine scientist, but he's also quite philosophically sophisticated and is sensitive to philosophical distinctions and the importance of reflecting philosophically on issues of science and religion. I had the privilege of participating in a conference with him in South Africa. I was invited to a conference, of all things, on galaxy morphology by the South African astronomer David Block. And I was offered the opportunity to give a paper upon God and the beginning of the universe. And my commentator was George Ellis. And you can imagine how intimidated I felt at that. Well, Ellis not only confirmed what I had said scientifically, but went on to offer moral and philosophical arguments for theism in response to my paper. So it was wonderful experience, and I enjoyed getting to know him personally and chatting at the conference as well. So I was very pleased when I saw this interview appear in Scientific American.
And this article, Bill, is kind of wrapped up in the caption on his photo where he says, "You cannot do physics or cosmology without an assumed philosophical basis."
Isn't that remarkable?
I'm looking at this article online here, Dr. Craig, if you'll take a look. First question that he is asked is, you were in a session called The End of Experiment. What was that about?
This is really an interesting feature of Ellis' thought. He believes that we have probably reached the limits of physics, of what we will ever be able to know about the fundamental physical structure of the universe. He says, many of the possible high-energy physics experiments and astronomy observations relevant to cosmology are now, in essence, nearly complete. Physics experiments are approaching the highest energies it will ever be possible to test by any collider experiment, both for financial and technical reasons. We can't build a collider bigger than the surface of the Earth. Thus, our ability to test high-energy physics, and hence the structures on the smallest of physical scales, is approaching its limits. Astronomical observations at all wavelengths are now probing the most distant cosmological events that will ever be seeable by any kinds of radiation whatsoever because of visual horizons for each form of radiation. So he's saying that in high-energy physics and in astronomy, we have now reached the limits of what we can discover about the universe. We can't build colliders that would have higher energies to probe more deeply into the subatomic structures of reality. We can't see any further out in the universe than we do because you get so far back close to the Big Bang that the universe then becomes opaque and you can't see beyond that horizon. It's like a horizon that surrounds us. So he's saying that physics has pretty much reached the limits that it will ever have. Now, this is really amazing because this is what physicists thought at the end of the 19th century. They thought that physics was then nearly complete. We've got the story now of the way reality is. And then came relativity theory and quantum theory and upset the whole apple cart. And what Ellis is saying is that the situation now is quite different than at the end of the 19th century. There they simply thought that they knew everything. He's saying what is the situation now is that we've reached the limits that are humanly possible for having any higher energy experiments or for probing more deeply into outer space. So he's saying that there is a kind of in principle reason for thinking that we've pretty much got the full physical story. Now, that's really remarkable, Kevin, because
you don't hear that very often.
No, it's astonishing. Yeah. And it's highly significant, I think, because what do skeptics so often say when confronted with evidence for the beginning of the universe or the fine-tuning of the universe? They say, future scientific discoveries will explain this. They appeal to a naturalism of the gaps and say, just because we haven't answered it yet, someday physics will explain the origin of the universe or the fine-tuning. And I think what Ellis is implying is that's not going to happen. He thinks that we're pretty much reached the limits, and therefore the worldview that contemporary science delivers to us right now is fundamentally correct, and the rest will simply be ironing out the details. And that means you can't escape things like the finitude of the past or the fine-tuning of the universe by just punting to the future discoveries of science.
And ironing out those scientific and physical details, we're also free to iron out the implications of what all that means, the philosophical implications.
Well, it would be different than ironing. The ironing out the details is simply fleshing out more fully the theories and the description of the world. But drawing philosophical implications, I think, is what you mean. And there certainly, I think, that the philosopher who reflects upon the data of science is free to draw the philosophical implications that these would suggest.
Several paragraphs down, he's asked about Lawrence Krauss. The interviewer asked, Lawrence Krauss, in A Universe from Nothing, claims that physics has basically solved the mystery of why there is something rather than nothing. Do you agree? Ellis says, certainly not. He is presenting untested speculative theories of how things came into existence out of a pre-existing complex of entities, including variational principles, quantum field theory, specific symmetry groups, a bubbling vacuum, all the components of the standard model of particle physics, and so on. He does not explain in what way these entities could have pre-existed the coming into being of the universe, why they should have existed at all, or why they should have had the form they did. And he gives no experimental or observational process whereby we could test these vivid speculations of the supposed universe generation mechanism. How indeed can you test what existed before the universe existed? You can't. And he lists a whole bunch of things there, Bill, that Lawrence Krauss calls nothing.
Yes, that's right, and explains that these are physical systems. It's just an excoriating critique, isn't it?
It really is. He says, thus what he is presenting is not tested science. It's philosophical speculation, which he apparently believes is so compelling, he does not have to give any specification of evidence that would confirm it is true. Ellis continues, it's very ironic when he says philosophy is bunk, and then himself engages in this kind of attempt at philosophy. It seems that science education should include some basic modules on Plato, Aristotle, Kant, Hume, and other great philosophers.
Yes, isn't that remarkable that here he is advocating that those who are educated as scientists need to have study of Plato, Aristotle, Kant, Hume, other great philosophers, as well as contemporary philosophers of science. You can imagine how I resonate with what he says here when he thinks that scientists need to have training in philosophy. What a different attitude from the attitude expressed by Krauss or by Hawking and Mladenov, where they say that philosophy studies nothing and that philosophy is dead. I think Ellis quite rightly understands the vacuity of those sorts of claims.
Yeah, and he says, go back and study Plato and Aristotle and Kant and Hume, and then read recent philosophers like Tim Maudlin and David Albert. He is then asked, are you or were you ever a believer in a final theory of physics? Ellis says, I certainly have believed in it as a possibility. What are we talking about here, Dr. Craig?
He's talking here about whether there is an ultimate theory of everything that would integrate all of the fundamental forces of nature. And he expresses a certain skepticism about whether this may be done. He says it may be that we wind up with two different intermeshed theories that ultimately can't be unified. And he says in the interview, it is, in my view, unlikely there is a unified theory of all fundamental forces. So this is very interesting that he thinks there may not be such a thing to be found.
He's asked, are you a fan of multiverse theories, string theory, the anthropic principle?
His answer to this comes in three parts. This is a written interview, not an oral interview, and so you need to tease apart the answers to these three questions successfully. The first question, are you a fan of multiverse theories? He answers no. He is not a fan of multiverse theories. Why? He says, well, it may be true, but unprovable. That's the first problem. There could be a multiverse, but it's unprovable that there is. And then he says, there's much too much untestable speculation about the existence of infinities of entities. Ellis has expressed this elsewhere. It's very interesting. He's quite skeptical about things that postulate actual infinites, like an actual infinite number of universes. He's skeptical that there is such a thing as these actual infinities of entities. Then he says, it involves ill-defined and untestable probability measures. And I think there he's probably thinking of with respect to trying to explain away fine-tuning. People like Sean Carroll, who think that by having a multiverse of worlds, you can manipulate the probability measures in such a way that it turns out that it's more probable we would have intelligent interactive observers like us rather than Boltzmann brains. I think Ellis is rightly skeptical about this. He calls this ill-defined and untestable probability measures. So for those three reasons, he's not a fan of multiverse theories. It's unprovable, too much untestable speculation about infinities, and the probability measures that are appealed to are ill-defined and untestable. Now, the second question, you recall, was, are you a fan of string theory? And this is the notion that instead of fundamental particles like quarks, there would be these little one-dimensional strings of energy which vibrate and thereby result in the existence of particles. And he again says, no, he's not a fan of string theories. He says, too much speculative introduction of very complex, unseeable entities. So again, he treats it as just untestable speculation. And he also doesn't like that it treats gravity just like any other force. As we saw a moment ago, he thinks that gravity may not be capable of being unified with the other forces of nature. And then finally was, are you a fan of the anthropic principle? And he says, yes. Now, here his answer needs to be carefully understood. He says, however one responds to it, it's a real question that deserves consideration. Fine-tuning of fundamental physics parameters is required in order that we can exist. Examining this issue has led to very many interesting studies. That makes it evident that by the anthropic principle, what Ellis means is the debate over the fine-tuning of the universe, that the universe is fine-tuned for our existence, and this cries out for some sort of explanation. He is a fan of that. He thinks that this is a serious problem that leads to interesting results. He's not a fan of the anthropic principle in the sense that the multiverse theorist uses it to say, well, somewhere in the infinite ensemble of worlds, there would be interactive intelligent observers, and so we ought not to be surprised at observing such a world. That he's already rejected in rejecting the multiverse. But the fine-tuning remains for him a serious question that deserves exploration.
Very interesting.
It is extremely interesting, isn't it?
He's asked, physicist Sean Carroll, who you've also debated, Bill, has argued that falsifiability is overrated as a criterion for judging whether theories should be taken seriously. Do you agree? As we get to his answer, let's talk a little bit about falsifiability.
As he uses it, he's not talking about a principle of meaning the way the original falsification principle was used. I think he's saying that a good scientific theory ought to be testable, basically, is what he's saying. We ought to be able to give some conditions under which we could test it by showing that it fails to yield the predictions, for example.
Be able to falsify it.
Yes, in a word.
Okay. Ellis says this is a major step backwards to before the evidence-based scientific revolution initiated by Galileo and Newton. The basic idea is that our speculative theories, extrapolating into the unknown and into untestable areas from well-tested areas of physics, are so good they have to be true. History proves that that is the path to delusion. Just because you have a good theory does not prove it is true. The other defense is that there is no other game in town, but there may not be any such game.
So I take it here that he is attacking speculative cosmological theories like Sean Carroll's model that was debated in my debate with Carroll. And what Ellis is saying is that these speculative theories that are unfalsifiable and untestable really are just sort of sterile metaphysics. It's ironic because he's accusing these cosmologists really of doing pure philosophizing without any kind of scientific testability, and so it's not really serious science. Ellis is committed to the view that really good science needs to have some kind of testability to it. And so this talk of multiverses and baby universes being spawned by a mother universe and all the rest, those very speculative, is just that. It's not good science, he thinks.
Finally, he's asked this question, and boy, has this been the topic of some of our podcasts lately, Bill. Krauss, Stephen Hawking, and Neil deGrasse Tyson have been bashing philosophy as a waste of time. Do you agree? Ellis says, if they really believe this, they should stop indulging in low-grade philosophy in their own writings. You cannot do physics or cosmology without an assumed philosophical basis. You can choose not to think about that basis. It will still be there as an unexamined foundation of what you do. The fact that you are unwilling to examine the philosophical foundations of what you do does not mean those foundations are not there. It just means they are unexamined.
Isn't that a remarkable statement? He says these men are doing low-grade philosophy, and they don't even realize it. So those assumptions, those foundations are still there, but they're unexamined. Really a damning indictment, I think.
He's asked, you are a Christian. Does your faith have any effect on your scientific views or vice versa? He says, it may affect to some degree the topics I choose to tackle, but it cannot affect the science itself, which has its own logic that must be followed wherever it leads without fear or favor within the domain of application to the relevant theories.
Right. So he's saying that while it may guide him in what he wants to study, science itself proceeds independently of his theological convictions.
He says many key aspects of life are outside of science, like ethics, what is good and what is bad, and aesthetics, what is beautiful and what is ugly. They lie outside the domain of scientific inquiry. Science can tell you what kind of circumstances will lead to the extinction of polar bears, or indeed of humanity, but it has nothing whatever to say about whether this would be good or bad. That is not a scientific question.
He's been very emphatic in his other writings about the importance of ethical and aesthetic questions as part of a synoptic worldview, and rejects the narrow scientism that says there are no ethical or aesthetic truths to be known because they're not scientifically discoverable. So he has a view of truth and of inquiry that recognizes that science is just one part of our attempt to get it the way reality really is.